Welcome, everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. For those of you who've been around this weekend, we had a Sangha work day yesterday morning, very well attended. We accomplished many things for our community, and we did it in the practice of mindfulness. We began with meditation, and then we worked quite well together in harmony with good concentration. Work as a practice. We talked about that in our Dharma talk last week. Last night we had a showing of this wonderful documentary, Dharma Brothers, I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Afterwards we had a panel of three members who work in Florida in prisons, sharing the practices of mindfulness and meditation with inmates, discussing their experiences. And here we are this morning. So, good. You know, we are in June, in our final month of this six-month-long practice period, dealing with selflessness, learning to live a less self-centered life. And many of the teachings, practices, retreats, intensives of these past months have dealt with that. Listening to the recitation of the five mindfulness trainings this morning, I cannot help be struck that they are all about selfless living. Because they deal with or they help us see more clearly that our individual actions, our personal actions in all areas have effects. And the effects, like ripples, are strongest closest to where the rock is thrown in. So our actions of body, speech, and mind have great effect on our own mind state, which means our own then well-being or ill-being, our own happiness or sadness, etc. But then they ripple out and have most effect on those people we are closest to. Those we are often we love, or we are in those kinds of relationships with. And yet oftentimes it is in those most intimate of relations, or closest of relationships, or relationships that have the most possibility for goodness, that we end up creating the opposite. And so that's interesting. And then, of course, as is very clear in the trainings, that these ripple out even further. And there are societal, global implications. Because we are part of, we are one cell of, this vaster earth body of humans and animals and plants and minerals and sky and environment and air. And the effects of each of us add up. And after a while, they begin to have effects that go beyond just our own immediate life, but move into the well-being of the world. So, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, in his first book on the Buddhist precepts, he called it For a Future to be Possible, which is interesting. This was before the dire predictions of global warming, sustainability, and everything else had become so prevalent. For a future to be possible. So, since it seems so strongly related, the practice of self and non-self and the practice of the five mindfulness trainings, and you know, many very strong statements were made in those trainings this morning very powerful ones. I wanted to just spend a few moments wondering if there are any questions that people had, things about the trainings that you heard this morning that you want further elaborated or that don't make sense to you, or does everybody remember them? As I say, they've gotten much more elaborated. The original Buddhist precepts are, do not kill, protect all life. Do not steal, protect the things of others. Do not engage in improper sexuality. Do not consume intoxicants, things like that. So they were basically one or two lines. And obviously, in the Thich Nhat Hanh community, they've been very elaborated because, again, Thich Nhat Hanh is very concerned with a Buddhism that is not just abstract, but a Buddhist practice that is very practical, meaning it really relates to all the aspects of daily life. So are there any, in listening this morning, any questions generally or any specific questions about anything you heard, anything not understandable, anything didn't sit right? Yes.
Unless this is about, never heard it before, think it was before, consuming volition. My understanding of volition is like will.
Mm-hmm.
Get that.
Right, so what is expressed in that, the question is consumption of will. How does will end up in consumption? Again, please understand that Thich Nhat Hanh is referring to is these nutriments, right? Nutriments are what? Things that give us sustenance, that sustain us, that's nutriments. And usually we think of nutriments as food, right? Nutrition, things we eat. But actually in those four nutriments, it's much vaster than that. It's really anything that is consumed by the mind and the senses affects it. So that's why we talk about sense objects. Right. So, in other words, things we are seeing, things we are smelling, things we are hearing, are also affecting our well-being. They are either nurturing us, or they are not nurturing us, neutral, or they are actually somewhat toxic. They are substances. So, if you look at volition, which means sort of like intention. Right, where I put my energies, what I attend to, you can see that that has a lot to do with, how I nurture myself and what I'm nurturing myself to. So in Buddhism, we pay very strict attention to intention and volition, because volition means choice. What I choose to do, what I choose not to do, how I choose to respond, and what I choose to eat or not eat, or what I choose to drink or not drink, or what I choose to put in my body or not put in my body, or how I choose to relate to other people and use their bodies and relate to their bodies. Right? So that is all very much in the realm of volition. So that's very key to understand that, again, we understand, in that training, in the strict traditional formulation, it really was just about intoxicants, primarily alcohol and drugs, do not do things, primarily because they tend to confuse the mind. They tend to dull the mind. And they tend to, or even elevate the mind in ways that don't produce any kind of lasting well-being or any, et cetera. So, I could go into that, but that was the framework. But obviously, you heard in the trainings, it's not just chemicals or not just substances, conversations, websites. movies, books. I mean, these are all things that can be toxic, because again, they are entering into our consciousness. Right? I mean, if we see that this mind of ours, this awareness of ours, how does it enter the world? How does it know the world? It knows the world through the senses, right? It knows the world by seeing the world, by hearing the world, by smelling the world, by tasting the world, by sensing and feeling the world, and then finally by thinking about, right? And so all these sense impressions, right, are, we could say, being consumed by the mind. Now, I guess I'm thinking of, in relationship to substances, right? There is a substance, right? One can choose to abstain from the substance. One can choose to, I guess, let's say in terms of, what's the term, like in drinking, it's be a social drinker. Or in terms of, I guess, drugs, they talk about recreational users. So it becomes part of somebody's life and affects one's life, but is not totally consuming. And then we know there are, multiple levels of addictions. And obviously, it begins with a substance. Which is really the mind, because the mind is really, hopefully, somewhat directing the body. We choose then how to introduce the substance into us, into our minds, into our bodies. And basically, what we are introducing, right, what it is. In other words, is it a substance? And I'm talking in this broader sense. Is it something that really contributes to my well-being, my happiness, my peace of mind, my joy, my stability? You know what I mean? All those positive qualities. Is this, or is it not? And when we can correctly label and see any type of substance for what it is, and whether it is beneficial or not beneficial, whether it is supportive of well-being or supportive of ill-being, hopefully, if we are conscious, right, then establishes how we want to relate to it and how much of it we want to consume and what its effect is on us. And that has a lot to do with what? With us. Right? Because we know that some people can go through life and, let's say, their relationship to alcohol is very non-consequential. They can take it or leave it. Their use of it is in no way abusive or anything, and if it's available, it's a non-issue. Other people, it is a road to hell. Right? And so, therefore, each of us have to establish, based on our own experience, the honesty of the effect that has on us. Right? In other words, to change the subject, some of us have the capacity of being around toxic people. Do we know what we're talking about? People with toxic relatives, toxic people. That's another thing. And we can do okay with it, right? We're not affected by them. They're just who they are, They don't, we're not affected by it. Other people are deeply affected by it. It's almost like the toxicity goes in them, and they're deeply affected by it. Or else you're around certain kinds of people in certain situations, and that really nurtures and supports negative habits, negative energy, negative kind of thinking in yourself. Somebody else, that may not be the case at all. So in this pattern of consumption, it is not only the substances that we have to be aware of and label correctly in terms of their effect on us, but also the very personal idiosyncrasy of each of us, which can change over time. Right? There may be a stage where you say, I just can't be around that person. You know, they're too powerful to me. my practice is too weak. You know what I'm saying? My development is too weak. They have too much of an effect on me. I really can't be around them. And maybe in time I will. Right? I mean, the analogy there is, if you're a thin tree that has a very thin bark, you can be eaten by animals. You know, cows or goats or other, they can eat you because your skin is not thick. So you have to be protected. You know, they put a little fence around the little seedling, right? But when the tree is 10 years old and has a thicker bark, you can take the fence away because, the animal can't chew its bark, it's thicker. And again, I'm really not advising thick skins. Because that's not necessarily, in Buddhism it's really more understanding and compassion ultimately gives us the capacity to be around and be in toxic environments and not be affected at all. Because we are coming from a place of understanding and compassion and non-self, and so our relationship to these toxic people is we accept them as they are, we are very aware of their suffering, and it doesn't get in, right? It doesn't get in. But many of us, it still gets in, right? And we have to be aware of that and really see that's practice. So when we look at consumption in that way, it's much bigger than just substances. Again, we have to be very honest. Food, right? We know that food, for many people, almost has become, has the qualities of becoming an addictive, abusive, toxic, right? Both in terms of some of the things we end up eating, the quantities of things we eat, things like that, right? So again, food in itself is benign. Food in itself is benign, most food. There obviously are foods these days that have no nutrition, they're junk food, or they are actually toxic. But even in general, nutritious food, right, is just nutritious food. But again, in terms of how we consume it and the patterns and all that, we can turn it into a toxic substance. We can turn shopping, right? They're just things. Things don't have any intrinsic value or have any, they're not really calling us. You just think about that for a moment. They're really not calling us. They don't have the capacity of saying, "Buy me, you'll be happy." That is all created by advertisers, marketers, in collaboration with what? Our own minds that buy into it. So again, so that's it's a wonderful kind of reformulation when it's seen that again, What really nourishes me? What are the nutriments that really support how I want to be? And therefore, what are those things, experiences, people, environments that don't? Good. Are there questions about the trainings? Yes. You must live in Florida.
Pardon?
You must live in Florida.
I really don't want to kill them all, but it's really not supposed to drink because of the suffering you cause of others. And I feel like the suffering I may cause by killing them, too, but as someone who grows food,
Yeah, that's a good one. And again, it's interesting in Buddhism. Oh, so the question is, from the level of household pests like mosquitoes or palmetto bugs, cockroaches as they're otherwise known, and or else if you're a gardener, you know, you're dealing with insects and bugs and other kinds of living things that may be wanting also to eat your eat your plants, or just generally in speaking, how do we really follow that training about not killing and protect all life, and yet there seem to be situations when it happens. And I think that's important that we understand that traditionally the presentation of the precepts or the trainings are just that. They are things that they're alive, let me say. They're alive. There are guidelines. Again, and the difference between the trainings in Buddhism and maybe what some of us are used to, which are commandments, you know, do or don't do, right? There's no wiggle room. There's no level for interpretation. They're commandments. Buddhism are not commandments handed down from on high. They're actually just basic fundamental teachings by other human beings who have some insight and understanding to help us look at, you know, how we conduct our life and live on life, and how to do it in a way that creates the least harm. And I think that's the key thing here, right? It is very hard in this life to absolutely do no harm. I mean, we do harm, or we hurt. Often, we can't help it, can we? I mean, we kill things when we drive, when we walk. You know, in India, there's a sect called the Jains. And if you ever see them, the Jain monks, and I don't know if they're nuns, but they wear a mask, sort of like like they wear in hospitals, you know, they wear those kinds of gauze masks, and they have a little broom, and so they do that so they won't inhale any insects, you know, accidentally. It's India, there are a lot of things flying around, and they're sweeping so they won't step on anything. As well as they have filters that they put over when they get water, so if there are any bugs in the water, they won't drink them. So it's very extreme. But I, the obvious thing is, just in ordinary life, it's hard not to injure something. And then moving up, there are things such as, you know, if you live in a home and you know there are insects, there are rodents, other things that are clearly unhygienic, harmful, or whatever. That happens in the production of food. Obviously, there is injury to living beings. So you balance off an absolute interpretation with an application that is always saying, do the least harm. Do the least harm. And when you have to take life, as we do from time to time, we can do it with a sense of awareness, one, that we are taking life. Because we know we live in a society where there's no acknowledgement of that. Right? There's no acknowledgement of that. There's no acknowledgement of it at the level you're talking, you know. I mean, pesticides. I mean, pesticides are about what? Killing living things, right? I mean, that's what they're about. There's no acknowledgement. I mean, now in war, they talk about killing people as, what's the phrase? Collateral damage. You know, no acknowledgement that the life of a living being, and I think collateral damage refers to quote-unquote innocent civilians, right? That's somehow a collateral damage and not the taking of life. A life that is as precious as our own. So, again, do as least harm as possible. but no, it is probably impossible never to do harm. But when we do it at least in acknowledgement of, perhaps do it with a sense of regret. You know, I wish I didn't have to take the life of this mosquito. I wish I didn't have to take the life of these cockroaches. I wish I didn't have to take the life of these rats. Right? I didn't have to take the lives of these caterpillars or whatever are eating your tomatoes. Again, if there are ways of eradicating without, you know, creating lots of harm, so much the better. We should do it again, least interfering, least harmful. But again, with a sense of regret. You know, it's also in human relations. I know. This is a little different, but it sort of talks about hurting and harming. It's a little more subtle. A lot of times people will say, oh, I don't want to do that because that'll hurt that person. You know? A lot of times people say in relationships, oh, I don't want to tell them that I don't want to be in relationship anymore, or that I really don't want to be with them, or because this may what? Hurt their feelings. But isn't that just part of life? I mean, do we say yes to everything? No. Many things we say no to. And that may disappoint another person who wants us to say yes. And that's just part of life, right? Again, there are ways of interacting in this life, in the world of human relationships. Again, as it's stated in the trainings, where we do our best to do the least harm to other human beings, to not see our relationships with other human beings as being fields of exploitation for me to meet my own needs. But we really enter the world of all types of human relations, you know, with a sense of mutuality and mutual respect. And again, to the best of our ability, to enter into relationships with integrity and openness and caring. But sometimes, we will say things or do things that may disappoint another human being. In the same way, they may do things that disappoint or hurt us. True? It's both sides. And part of our own growing up, part of our own maturity, part of our own learning to live in the world and not create melodramas is to understand that is true. That's okay. And so, again, even when we have to deliver a message to somebody, we can do it with regret. Regret meaning, I wish, you know, I know this may cause you disappointment or hurt or whatever. I'm sorry, but I mean, I remember when I was, a director of a mental health center. Sometimes I had to, I guess a nice way of saying it is let people go. You know, just for the well-being of the organization. You know, I wouldn't call that the most positive aspect of the job. Not the most fun message you want to deliver to people. But yet, again, in Mahayana Buddhism, the greater good is always a criteria in often making our moral choices. There is an apocryphal story going back to the Buddha. So we get away from absolutes. Again, do not kill. But if someone is about to kill somebody else, do you do everything you can to stop that? even if it meant having to really harm that person to protect other people. Obviously, as a society, we make choices like that, don't we? So, it just came to mind, but I think it's apocryphal story of the Buddha, probably in a prior life. But if I remember correctly, if anybody remembers, I think he's a monk, and he's on a boat going from here to there, and he becomes aware that, and there are a lot of merchants or whatever on the boat, and he's aware that there is I can't remember, one or several robbers who are planning to kill everybody on the boat. And so they can get all their goods. And in the story, I feel bad saying it because it just kind of popped into my mind, and I may be telling it wrongly, so please. there are probably special Buddhist hells for teachers who tell make up stories. I'd rather not end up there. So that's why. Anyhow, to my recollection, and I guess because there was no other alternative, the Buddha did take his life. I don't know if he threw him overboard or what he did. But he did take his life. And the story is told, it was told to me as I remember it, to just say that even the Buddha, right, the epitome of do no harm, do not kill, in a certain circumstance, for the benefit of others, to protect the many, may do that. There's a famous story that's actually more historically in Tibetan Buddhism. There was a very powerful king. His name was Langdharma, and this was after Buddhism had been in Tibet for hundreds of years, and he was part of a clique, kind of an anti-Buddhist clique of the old timers. who had seized power, and he was hell-bent on destroying Buddhism, destroying monasteries, killing monks and nuns, doing all kinds of stuff. And it was a great meditation master, I think his name was Yeshe Dorji, but who took it upon himself to take the life of Langdharma. And if you ever pictures about Tibetan Buddhist a ritual, you'll often see something called the Black Hat Dance. And it's actually reenacting the story of Langdharma, because supposedly he, if I remember correctly, he he had a white horse, and he usually wore white, but he kind of painted his horse black, and he dressed up in this kind of elaborate costume, and went to where this king was, and started doing this very elaborate kind of entrancing dance. That I think, if I remember, he also was carrying a bow and arrow, and when he got close enough, he shot Langdharma and killed him. And when this story was told to me, it is said one can only do an action like that, and it really ties in with the other story I told you about the Buddha, if one has two things. If one has insight, so one really understands clearly the situation and can really impartially see the massive amount of harm that this person is doing, and secondly, and as importantly, one is not acting from anger. One is there, this is an awakened gesture of protecting beings, and there is no anger against the person. If anything, there is regret, but an understanding that this person is just so deluded and so violent that left to their own devices, they are going to continue to create harm and they need to be stopped. So these kind of stories are told by teachers in their explanation of the precepts, but with the caveats, that those kinds of actions, where one actually is outwardly doing a harmful act, should only be done from the purest motivation. It sort of ties in with, that kind of choices are in our own culture with Les Miserables, right? You remember Jean Valjean, who did what? What was his great crime? He stole a loaf of bread. And why did he, which was a crime? Do not steal. Right? Do not steal. And yet he supposedly, not supposedly, but in the story, he stole a loaf of bread because his nieces and nephews were starving. Right? We could say a compassionate action to alleviate the suffering of others. So again, I think in our own life, we can see that even though there are absolutes, right, it is said that in various the Mahayana sutras, it is said that the great bodhisattvas take on many forms to help beings. And it is said very clearly, I forget the Sarangam Lankavatara Sutra, that, and in the Vimalakirti Sutra, that they will, they may manifest as bartenders. They may be sitting on the stool next to alcoholics. They manifest in all these realms, but they have, but their minds are very clear and they're only there for one purpose, which is to show people another way. So in that sense, it is often said, one should never judge the actions of others, even when they appear to be quote unquote wrong, because behind that may be somebody who is trying to help another human being. So we don't want to turn the precepts and Buddhist morality into, becoming goody-goody two-shoes. You know how that one is. Because that can also be a form of egoism. Look how pure I am, all these people out there just mucking around in filth. And I'm so pure. So that just becomes another ego enhancement. We shouldn't judge other people, and sometimes to help other people in compassion and wisdom, we have to get our hands a little dirty. And that's okay. If we're really at a place where we are not affected by the dirt, that's where we got to be honest with ourselves. I think you understand. It's 12 o'clock. We'll end. Thank you.